This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you probably know, we build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
This week it's the three Bs, Barns, Bards and the Borders.
I don't honestly think there's any getting past this. The world has gone clean skite. Basically, over a week ago, we had 16 and a half degrees. Since then, we've had snow, rains, hurricanes, tempestos, you name it. It is all happening in February here in Scotland. Do we complain? Not at all. We revel in all of it. I'm Mark Stevens, sitting right beside me here at the fire in Beechgrove in Aberdeen, Rachel Stewart.
Yeah, no one believes a word of that.
What, that we don't complain? No.
Yeah.
We complain bitterly all the time.
My friend actually said she feels just now like we're living permanently between a yellow and red weather zone.
Yeah.
And that is what it feels like. But I think there's sun in the horizon. I noticed that
there's sun
in the forecast over the next few days. So all will be good. We just need to keep the faith.
Aye.
Uh-huh.
It's only being so cheerful it keeps us going.
Do let us know what your plans are for today. Will you be going out and getting wet, or will you be staying in? Get in touch, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295, or it's Alex here manning the phones this morning on 0808 92950.
Alex came into the car park on two wheels, ran into the building, a coffee-seeking missile.
Where's the machine? Blame him.
It's here, exactly. Last week we were celebrating Imok, and today it's the very day to celebrate the Lunar New Year. And this year is the Year of the Dragon.
Yeah, we've already had an email actually from Bruce in Beijing. Best wishes for the Year of the Dragon. The dragon, a highly auspicious symbol for China and Chinese people worldwide. Today is the start of Chinese New Year. This week has witnessed probably the world's largest human migration, as a large proportion of China's population have made the long journey home for family reunion to be together for the start of the new year. A fascinating time to be in China, he says. Lovely. Now, a mystery sound. You know what? We've been putting the listeners to work because this sound comes from Nick Brett. See if you can guess what it is.
River dance, rehearsal one.
Good guess. Good guess.
But wrong.
Email us, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or ring us on 0808 92950.
There is an awful lot of ground out there in terms of school playgrounds and playing fields around Scotland, which is not normally regarded as green space or indeed as productive space, but it is there.
It is there. It's huge, actually. It's either tarmac or grass playing fields. That's what we're talking about. And it's roughly the size of Dundee. Can you believe that?
Imagine what you could do with that amount of ground if you actually designed it differently, what it might mean for biodiversity, for learning and well-being even.
Yeah, well, Helen went along to Leavenmouth High School in Buckhaven in Fife, where a patch of unloved ground at the back of this relatively new school is undergoing a transformation. Let's begin with pupil Connor, who just loves this place.
Oh, my favourite part is probably over there near the trees, just because you can see all the fields for miles and then the hills at the back.
Is that the Lomond Hills over there?
Yeah.
And do you like being outside?
Oh, yeah. I think it's better than being in a classroom anyway. This is probably the most fun I've had in my whole school career, actually.
I'm Duncan Sewell. I'm a teacher. In 2017, the school had been open for 1 year and we actually didn't know that we owned this part. This was basically a ploughed 5-acre field that was later planted with some trees that didn't do very well. And so I took an interest in what this place was and thought, what would it be like if a school tried to install nature into this area? What would the benefits be?
What was it like before you set to?
It was just planted grass, a very empty, we called it green deserts.
Well, maybe you can describe some of it for me and what you've done and the different areas.
Well, we've got a native woodland of about 9,000 trees and we've got a permaculture circle here.
What do you mean by a permaculture circle?
Basically, we dug a circular ditch and then we buried all kinds of wood inside the ditch and then we covered it up and the wood has rotted and become like a sponge so that it irrigates the plants and trees and berries that we've planted in the circle.
What kind of trees have you got?
This is willows, a lot of hawthorn. Oaks do quite well because we've got a lot of deer here that do a lot of damage to the trees, but they seem to leave the oaks alone. We've got 200 fruit trees to plant in an orchard over in the south of the project. We've now got a shipping container with lots of tools and things that we use. We've got rural skills qualifications that we're teaching here, but the whole point is to get people outside and enjoying nature.
This is our project to stop the water from getting all like this.
Because there's a lot of water here and a lot of mud, and it actually looks like you might have been having some fun.
We're trying to stop that.
You're trying to stop the water, so you're trying to contain the water.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll get ducks in that in the summer.
So what does that actually involve you doing then?
Digging in a path and then digging deep so all the water flows into there.
So it's basically you're trying to make some kind of dam.
Yeah.
That sounds like the best possible fun.
And we're putting a bridge over there so people can just walk over it. It's just fun to be outside than trapped in the school.
Does it feel like being trapped in there sometimes?
Yeah. Because you just sit there and they work. But here you get to do what you want sometimes.
And you literally are covered in mud from the head to your toes. What about the whole idea of this turning into something? You have a vision for it, you put the work in.
And hopefully it comes out all right.
How do you think that might feel?
Good. It'll prove we've done something.
We've been working on it for a good while.
It'd be nice for people to look at.
A couple of years ago, me and a group of people who were a part of the Eco Committee, we used to come round here all the time and help out. And we did a few projects here.
Sonny is one of the pupils who has wellies on.
If you could see how it was, it's such a drastic difference that you wouldn't believe it was the same place. So there's a lot of like different variety of plant life. And it just brings in so much more wildlife as well. There's frogs here now, there's different insects. The deer still come. They're a problem, but there's
too many deer.
Yeah, too many.
What do you get out of coming here and spending time in this place?
Well, I think that everyone would agree that being outside is much better than like being in a classroom. I think that when you're outside and you're either with friends or helping out, like doing a project like this, you get so much more out of it. It just feels better to do than sit in a class.
In what way does it feel better?
So, like, when you're in a class, you're, like, sitting down for 45 minutes, you're, like, your legs are cramping, your hand's cramping from writing too much, you're just bored. Whereas out here, like, you could just look around, like, there's a lot more to see out here than there is in a class.
So you feel more stimulated?
Yeah, stimulation. There's more things to do, to see.
Are you thinking of, in terms of your future, actually maybe doing something in the outdoors?
Yeah, that's pretty much my whole career path, to be honest. I'm hoping to go into ecology and conservation to try and do more of this for other places.
I'm Matt Robinson and I'm Chief Operations Officer at Learning Through Landscapes, and we're the National School Grounds Outdoor Learning and Play charity. School grounds in Scotland, if we add them all together, add up to the size of the city of Dundee.
Wow, and that's a lot of ground.
That's a huge amount of ground. You know, there's our new national park if we want it. And 80% of that space is mown grass or tarmac. They're not great for learning, and they're certainly not great for climate adaptation, resilience, biodiversity, and all these other kind of agendas that we've got going on at the moment. So we've been working and looking at what is the potential for using the spare spaces we've got around schools and the great spaces that we've got. We still need sport. We still need playground spaces in all weathers. But where there's space like this, what if we could plant forests and shrubs and manage water and create more climate resilient spaces for schools, but also teach that future generation to, I guess, connect to these land and these places and learn the skills? There needs to be a change. We need to reinvent what school grounds are like and what they're here for.
In S3 and S4, I had really bad anxiety, so I'd kind of come out here with Mr. Resolve to like get a bit of a mental health break from all the people. We just kind of plant trees and like walk around. It was kind of the first time that I'd ever done stuff like that.
And how did you find the whole experience of planting a tree?
It was quite fun.
And you mentioned the fact that it was a nice break from being in the school and around people. What do you think it is about here that makes you feel better?
It's quiet. It's really calm. Like, there's not many people come up here. There's so many like trees, just quiet places you could go.
The fact is that most of the teachers don't come out here. How can we change that? Because I know that there is so much that can be learnt here. So much about biology, there's things about math, there's all sorts of subjects could be applied here with a bit of imagination and willing, surely.
Well, we attract ducks by making dams. We can attract the teachers. We can attract the teachers by better design. It is inside our job remit. We should be going outside. We should be doing outdoor stuff. But I have to say, I'm a lot of sympathy with the teachers who have got enough to do.
I totally understand. But then we've already heard that there's such a strong well-being aspect to it as well, that they might actually feel better and de-stressed if they could spend a bit of time here as well as the pupils.
Yeah, and it is about staffing as well, because it's one thing to bring five people out here on a nurture basis to get some fresh air to decompress. It's another thing to bring 30 children out.
And I think Duncan's reflecting some current research at the moment. So Stirling University, every 3 years, look at the kind of state of outdoor learning in Scotland within our schools and where it takes place and how much. And we know since the pandemic, that has plummeted. And it's really dropped off a cliff. And some of this is the stress, the busyness on teachers. And that has to be balanced with, there's this opportunity. We're quite happy to spend tens and hundreds of thousands of pounds on wonderful technology and amazing buildings. And then there's 50 quid and half an hour left for the grounds. I'm dreaming a dream. I'm the glass half full
kind of person. You have to dream, though.
And we've got to find a way of supporting teachers. And some of that is creating the space. Some of that's creating the time and allowing pupils to start this learning journey.
I would hope for it to keep on going as far as it can for people like me who hate school to, quite frankly, get a break from it and come out here.
That was Connor, who goes to Levermouth High School in Fife. We also heard from teacher Duncan Zool, who's the driving force behind this project, and Matt Robinson from Learning Through Landscapes, as well as other pupils from the school. You could spend a productive couple of minutes talking about how you would design a landscape to attract teachers.
Oh, yeah, you said.
I suspect it would involve sofas, warmth and coffee.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I know from my own daughters that they love being outside, and that's how they learn. And if you look at, you know, things like the theories of how people learn, it's often by doing. And, of course, the outdoors gives you great potential for that because you can do practical things. And if you do practical things, the sort of knowledge sticks in your head. And I was at St Cyrus last summer, and they had beach school there, which was just amazing. And the kids were learning den building and how to identify different food sources, and that led into a bit of local history, and they were just totally engaged throughout the whole process.
Now, my eldest daughter's a primary teacher and she loves teaching outside, you know, and there's heaps of stuff you can do that. It just it's approaching it a different way. And you know, if you look at those little sort of forest primary schools or nurseries that they've got and what have you, it doesn't matter what the weather is. Mm-hmm. You know, the kids really don't care.
Yeah.
You know, if they're properly happed up, they're fine.
Oh, yeah. Just wrap them up, hats and gloves, and you're good to go.
Yeah, as long as they don't sit in puddles too long. Two rare needlework samplers, thought to have been embroidered by Robert Burns' sister and mother, have been returned to the poet's birthplace thanks to an American donor. Now, the pieces had been part of a private collection in England for decades, but were auctioned off last year.
Yeah, the National Trust for Scotland now plan to put them on public display after their conservators have given them a thorough inspection. Caroline Smith from the Robert Burns Birthplace Museum in Alloway told me more about the significance of these samplers in the 18th century.
Well, samplers are pieces of fabric, usually linen, where young ladies, or young girls really, would practice their needlework. They would then use those skills to embroider linen within their household when they became mature and married or whatever. So these are skills that they would use later on in life. So they would often copy motifs and designs and practice all the different kinds of stitching and detail.
So were they ever meant to go on display then, or not really?
Sometimes in households they would be framed and put on a wall for display. So maybe you'd see a sampler that was in the family that would then be used as a bit of a template for a young girl to copy, maybe from an older sibling or from a mother. And that's kind of what we have here. We have two samplers, one by Agnes Brune, the poet's mother, Robert Burns' mother, and her daughter, Isabella, copying some of those motifs within her own sampler. So you can see a distinct link between the two in the designs.
You're going to open them up for us.
Because
they've not long come into your possession, have they?
No, we just received them a couple of months ago. They came up for auction, and a collector of samplers in the States purchased them through auction and then very, very kindly donated them to us, because obviously there's a clear connection between these and Robert Burns.
Well, let's have a look.
So this is the smaller of the two and the more recent. And you'll be able to see once they're side by side, it's quite apparent that it's more recent than the other one. So on the back of this one is the details of when it was shown in the Scottish Exhibition in Glasgow in 1911. If I turn it over, you can see the colours are really still quite vivid on this one.
Yeah, so
this,
lots of reds and pinks and some blue there too.
Yeah, so this is the one that we believe was done by Isabella Burns.
Very delicate in appearance. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and you can imagine this style with these borders. You know, she could adorn her own pieces of fabric, whether it's towels, linen, or items of clothing, with her own stitching.
So I can see some coronets and some flowers, some other motifs as well.
Yes, and you'll see those in the other one as I unwrap it. So you can see this one, the colours are much more faded. It's much older than the other one, but you can see a repeat of the patterns.
So the daughter learning from her mum.
Yeah, uh-huh. And you can actually imagine that she would have unrolled her mother's sampler and started to learn and practice the stitching techniques and the designs that her mother had.
And this one has obviously a bit more to it. We've got the alphabet here as well.
Yeah, there are letters of the alphabet on Isabella's, but it's a much smaller piece. But on this one, it's much, much more detail in this. It's very neat. You can see the letters of the alphabet. There's also some detail in here that we can't quite make out. But we're hoping that once we establish the condition of it by the conservator and some cleaning perhaps is done to the fabric, that it will reveal a bit more of the detail.
So do we know when they were done, when they were completed?
Well, usually a sampler would have been done by a young girl from the age of about 5 to 12 years of age. And Agnes Brown was born in 1732, so we think the sampler would have been done by her around about 1740 to 1745, so early 18th century. Isabella Burns was born in 1771, so later on in the 18th century, so probably around about 1770 to 1785.
So they are very old, but they do look like they're in pretty good condition, from what we can see here anyway.
Yeah, and I think obviously the fact they've been framed has helped to preserve them. They were given to a family, Mrs. McNaughton, who was the wife of Reverend George McNaughton, a minister in Dumfries, by Isabella Burns's daughter, who was also called Isabella Burns Begg. This is where it becomes a bit complicated. So she would have been the granddaughter of Agnes Brown. So she was known to have donated or sold various items that belonged to the family. So we don't know whether these were sold or given to Reverend McNaughton and his wife, but probably around about 1880, before Isabella Burns Begg died.
Now, did you know that these were in existence?
I think we were aware of them, but we didn't know an awful lot about them.
So obviously very exciting for you to now get them.
Yeah, really exciting because, you know, people think about Burns and the women in his life and they think about, you know, his wife and his lovers, whereas these were members of his family, close family, his sister and his mother. And I think, you know, the whole story about the social history of women's lives at that time, you know, how they lived, the kind of things they did in their spare time, if they had any spare time, and the skills that they had. I mean, these are really intricate, and to think that a young girl between the age of 5 and 12 would have known and had the skills to do this is really quite something, I think.
Caroline Smith there from the Robert Burns Birthplace Museum in Alloway. I'm trying to remember when it was. I was across in America at a poetry festival, and I was talking to this lady from California, and she said, "Yeah, where are you from?" I said, "Scotland." "Oh, all right, fine, okay." And she says, "Oh," she says, I'm related to people from Scotland." And I said, "Just about everybody here will be, truth to be told." And she says, "Yeah," she says, "you know, says, my great 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 grandfather was a poet. I don't know whether you've ever heard of him, Robert Burns." I said, "Yes, I've heard of Robert Burns, yes, yes." And her name was Patricia Burns Traxler.
Right. You know,
and she was able to demonstrate quite clearly mm-hmm. that she was actually connected, you know, to the family. So
impressive.
The stuff there.
Yeah, very impressive.
Coming up, a bird paradise in the Borders and a community nature reserve in Fife.
And of course, we've got a mystery sound for you today. Let's have a listen. Some guesses already. The first one from Colin S. in Glasgow. The mystery sounds like hail when you're in a car or tent.
And David John Chadwick Luke says, anticipating a drenching, we'll be well happed up when we go out and about with our two golden retrievers. It says, I think the mystery sound is a cloth finishing machine. Mm-hmm. And he then adds, Kung Ho Fat Choi, which apparently is a Chinese New Year greeting.
Very nice.
Well, it would be if it was right, but I'm sure it's not.
Craig in Bearsden.
Well, not the way I said it. Anyway, he's probably spot on. But...
is the mystery sound a potato turner?
And this is saying, Denise and Phil saying, it's a dreary start to the weekend in Rothes. Reggie the Black Lab was drookit on his 5:40 a.m. walk. Is the mystery sound a large farm in Tackety Beach chasing a bag of tatties tumbling down a wooden staircase? That is uncanny, Denise and Phil. Uncanny. Spot on. If you've got any idea what the sound might be, you can get in touch.
Yep, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or you can give us a ring 0808 592 9500.
The other day, I was wandering about in the rain and sleet, looking at flamingos and kookaburras and emus in a location where, frankly, I wasn't expecting to find them, in the Borders near Lauder at a place called Bird Garden Scotland. Owen Joyner showed me round.
Bird Garden Scotland has two key objectives. The first one is to promote a more sustainable way of living. Of course, the visitor centre is part of that exhibit, part of that description and explanation. And the other key objective we have is to conserve the natural world. And that has a massive umbrella of objectives underneath it.
Tell me about the building.
So the visitor centre is actually an eco-build. It's made from straw bales. We wanted to go really rustic with a lime render and really turf roof, really rustic approach, but we had to build something according to planning that looked like a barn. So it looks like a barn, straw bale build, reclaimed floor, Durham University's gymnasium. All the furniture and things are reclaimed or upcycled, and we've managed to pull it off with a reasonably chic finish, which is good.
Yeah.
The building is off-grid completely, so even the internet's 4G. We've got our borehole on site and all the power comes off the roof into battery storage, and in the depths of winter when it's dark we've got a biofuel generator as backup.
That's an excellent idea. I saw that it was a straw bale build because you've left a little window in the inside in the cafe and you can actually see the straw on the inside. I mean, basically you just pile up bales and then use that as the main structure. The insulatory properties of it must be quite good.
It's fantastic. We've got a log burner in the coffee shop, but actually that's the only heating we have.
All right.
And quite often we dull it down because it just gets too warm in there. But what's nice is it's the same temperature pretty much summer and winter. It's very, very stable.
Oh. So what is the official status of this place? Are you essentially a zoo?
So we're a zoo. We haven't gone for charitable status. We've gone for, it's quite a clunky name, it's a community interest company. It's got many parallels to a charity, but it means that Mark and I, as the founding directors, our interest is a lot more maintained and secure than with a board of directors on a charity.
It's a wild day down here today. And you've got emus the other side of this.
It's nice to bring people and quirky animals like emus into contact. A lot of Australian wildlife is in trouble at the moment. Some of these incredible bushfires we've been seeing and flooding and what have you. And there's lots going on there. And of course, kids absolutely adore them because they're living cousins of the Tyrannosaurus family. So when you bring that in, you capture the kids' imagination. And when you've got the imagination, that's when you can drop in conservation messages and ideals. So the emus are here really to inspire the kids.
I took a wander around here earlier, mm-hmm. you know, and you've got quite a lot of domestic species here too.
Yes, so there's a massive history and quite an important culture and heritage relationship between domestic poultry and people. I mean, it goes on for millennia and it spans pretty much the globe. We've got quite a lot of rare breeds here. We've got the Shetland goose and the Shetland duck in this orchard, and they're two priority breeds for the Rare Breed Survival Trust. So their survival is actually quite important, and you know, we want to celebrate that relationship between birds that have adapted to live in Scotland, and like the little Scots stumpies there with their little legs. You know, they're a rare breed that's under threat. And whilst breeds, technically, you could recreate them, you could rebreed them, unlike a wild species, which once that's gone, it's gone forever. As we've got them, we should preserve them and we should bring people in contact with them.
Give me just a sense of how many varieties that you have here. What are they?
So we've got about 600 birds on site at the moment.
It's not that big a site.
No, it's only 9 acres, but only 7 of which we're developing. Uh-huh. This guy laughing at us here.
That's an odd noise.
It's an odd noise. He's a paradise or New Zealand shell duck. This whole section of the grounds that we're in at the moment with the emus, the wallabies and the shell duck here, this is a very antipodean area. We're going to develop a lot of this into some of the parrots and pigeons from down under as well.
It does kind of sound like, you know, a kid having a wild time with a kazoo.
It does, yeah. They feel like you're getting mocked sometimes by them. Yeah.
You got ponds. What's that across the other side?
So that's a Cereopsis goose, or Cape Barren goose, much easier to spell than Cereopsis. But Cereopsis basically translates to waxy eye. They've got this amazing luminous green sort of area above their beak, which has been given their name. A lot of the ducks, geese and swans are very descriptively named. We've got the Cereopsis, or waxy eye. We've got the black swan. It's obviously a swan and it's black. the white-faced whistling duck gets white-faced and it whistles.
Oh, you've got kookaburras too.
And there's kookaburras, yeah, yeah. They're not doing so great in the wild just now. Barbed wire and bushfires and the toxic cane toads are really not doing them a lot of favours.
No, I can imagine.
So in this aviary, for instance, we've got bears poached, which are rapidly declining in the wild. So we're part of their breeding programme. We've got Laysan duck, which were extinct, which means they were extinct in the wild, but thankfully, due to zoos and considered sort of breeding programmes, have been reintroduced and are doing really well. So
I've never heard that word before, extinct.
Yeah, it just means gone from the wild.
Gone from the wild.
Yeah. And we've got the crowned cranes over there, the national bird of Uganda. Talk about colourful and plumage and being
wonderful.
A bit ostentatious. They have it all.
Yeah, yeah. Just magnificent. You know, and that's our rider, isn't it?
That is our eider, yes, yes. Okay. So that's really interesting to have native species like eiders, because everyone's heard of eider down pillows and what have you, but very few people have actually laid eyes on one. And the number of people here go, oh, look, that's an eider. And just that little connection generates a sense of care. And once that sense of care is in place, then people are more concerned about these birds' features.
You've got flamingos here. It's almost like a sort of boathouse they're coming out of.
That's the flamingo house, yes. We sold the flamingos' names. You have to be quite resourceful when you're building a zoo in terms of funding. So we sold the flamingos' names, and that paid for the flamingo house.
You can avoid migratory species by taking a central location in Scotland. However, I doubt if you can avoid predators. Are you bothered by that?
We have a 6-foot fence that's underwired. We are going to put a hot wire around
it as
well. It's dug down to prevent digging things, so primarily the fox. We don't use the F word here regularly, but the fox, that prevents them coming in. But we're between 3 shooting estates, so the gamekeepers obviously control the foxes, so they protect us as well, but we do have the preventative around our perimeter.
Owen Joyner there of Bird Garden Scotland near Lauder, and we'll hear more from Owen and the inhabitants of the garden a little later in the programme.
Yeah, sounds like a fascinating place.
Well, bearing in mind it's only about 8 or 9 acres, something like that, and they've crammed a lot in. And there's a lot to see there, and it's really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and the flamingos particularly.
Oh, yeah. You like a flamingo, don't you?
I do like a flamingo.
We've been playing the collective nouns game.
Indeed.
Yeah. Go on then. What's the collective noun for flamingos?
A flamboyance.
That's brilliant.
They've got emus too.
Mm-hmm. Go on then.
That's a mob of emus.
I like emus.
And there's a riot of kookaburras.
And my favourite, come on, an embarrassment of pandas. Love that.
Yeah, I checked that. And yeah, the embarrassment does show, but it also says something about a cupboard of pandas, and that doesn't make any sense to me at all. A cupboard of pandas. How chaotic would that be?
You'd get a shock, wouldn't
you? Yeah, well, exactly. Coming up, we've got rescue dogs on a large scale. I mean, these are really seriously large. And how to sustainably protect our trees without using plastic.
And, of course, we've got a mystery sound for you today. This comes from a listener, Nick Brett.
See, I have actually heard a very similar sound to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I will give you a clue here, actually. There's lots of them.
What a clue. Some guesses.
Generosity is my middle name.
Alistair Elkin says, excellent programme as usual. I think today's mystery sound is a rare recording of the late Max Bygraves' small rodents from Amsterdam warming up their clogs. Apologies if people of a certain age now have an earworm for the rest of the day.
That's exactly. They're on the stair. They're on the stair. Right there. Is that the one?
I don't know. Is it?
Yeah, no, I don't know. Alan Douglas has been in touch. Former BBC saying, I believe the mystery sound is my car suspension as I drive through the contraflow along the freshly patched surface of the Brechin bypass on the A90. Yes, Alan, I think we've all been there.
I like those guesses. Very good. Get in touch if you think you know what it is. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or give us a ring 0885 92 95 00.
You may remember last week I visited a natural burial ground called Delafour near Granton-on-Spey, which is looked after by Duncan Grant. Now, off the back of that, we received the following email from the MacLeod family saying, thank you for your visit to Delafour Burial Ground. Our dear son Norman is buried there, having died at the age of 49 with a brain tumour in July 2016. He was an amazing guitarist and at one time worked as arts director at Melody Maker.
We live in Granton and being able to visit such a tranquil burial ground is a great comfort to us. We were able to choose Norman's elevated plot where we can sit and look over the beautiful river view. And that's from Alistair Helen and son Colin MacLeod.
It is a beautiful location.
Yeah, that's a lovely email. Thanks very much for getting in touch.
Yeah.
Now, a few years ago, an area of grassy scrub came into community ownership near Crail. Public consultations were carried out and results showed that most people wanted the site on the edge of the old airfield to be used to benefit nature and the environment. So a few weeks ago, the diggers moved into Kilmining Community Nature Reserve to start work on creating a new meadow and wetland, which Will Cresswell thinks will bring huge benefits in the long term.
Almost all of the wetland areas in the East Nuke have been lost. Obviously, the main priority in the area is agriculture. Brilliant, we all need to eat. But that's often at the expense of peripheral habitats and things like marshy corners of fields. Even in my time, last 25 years in Crail, they've been progressively drained. And that just reduces the quality. It's sort of death by a thousand cuts. At Kilmining, we have an opportunity to restore a wetland. If you look at the historical maps, there used to be a mill pond here, a mill race. There used to be a burn. And with just a little bit of digging and a little bit of clay, hopefully we can restore that and create a habitat, which is very, very rare in the area.
So you're going to create a wetland and also a meadow as well. How are you going to do that? Because that looks like it could be quite tricky, given that this area has a lot of tarmac on it.
Meadows are actually a nightmare because they require a lot of management, or you need to have big grazers, or you need to be a farmer with lots of sheep. Ideally, with a meadow, you want what's known as nature-based solutions. So the tarmac, which is left of the airfield, which we can't actually do anything about. It's historic, it's listed, but we can cover it with soil. And that might actually create a really interesting nature-based solution for meadows, because it's not, as you might imagine, tarmac's not great for drainage. So in the winter, it's probably going to be a bit boggy. And in the summer, it'll be really quite dry. Not great conditions for growing trees, but there should be this golden sort of period between sort of March and about June, which is perfect for meadow plants. So I'm hoping we end up with a top-class meadow area sitting on the tarmac. The soil from the wetland that we're digging out will create that level on the tarmac, but we won't have to manage it into the future. But ecological sort of creation of habitats is an uncertain science. But whatever we end up with, it will be better than the tarmac. at the moment, I'm slightly horrified to see the digger effectively, you know, digging out this lovely habitat that I've been visiting for many, many years to look at wildlife and birds. But I'm reassured that nature always comes back. You've just got to leave it the space. And of course, we're going to help it. We've already planted 2,500 trees on the site. And brilliantly, 95% of them are still alive two years on, which is a fantastic survival rate. Real testament to the volunteers, people in the local community that came down and planted each one with tender, loving care, thinking about the future.
How soon will we see the pond here then?
Oh, the big question. If you talk to the construction manager, the pond will be dug in about 4 weeks. But as I look at the weather, I think it's going to take a little bit longer than that. But certainly by the end of February, and then we'll do planting of more trees, landscaping, and planting of the meadow in March. Going to have a big volunteer party to get that going and celebrate that. And then hopefully by July time, it might even look nice.
You are an avid birder, and you can tell you've got your binoculars around your neck just now, and whenever there's anything in the sky, your eyes are drawn to it. This is a fab place, though, isn't it, for spotting birds, and presumably you think it'll get even better when you do all of this work.
Don't get me started, but we're about 40 standing about 40 metres away from a little bench. Made by someone called Willie Irving, and if you sat on that bench for a whole year, you would see probably between about 180 species, and some of those species would be the kind of rarities that people from all over Scotland come down here. Spectacularly, we had a couple of years ago, we had a Siberian thrush, the first mainland Siberian thrush, and the tarmac was absolutely full of birders for several days, and I've seen many fantastic birds from, say, Vietnam, Siberia, India, and so on, that end up here, particularly in the autumn, basically because Kilmining is the first piece of greenery that you encounter if you've been blown off course from Siberia across the North Sea, and it's like this little oasis, and they land down here, and there's enough habitat to keep them. And it's quite open habitat as well, so the bird watchers can see it. It's a really good spot, one of the best in Scotland.
If we come back in 20 years, what will this spot look like? What's the dream scenario?
Well, I can see it very clearly in my mind, but you'll have to use your imagination. But coastal wetlands are absolutely wonderful places, and quite variable in terms of the water level. So late summer, there's a lot of exposed mud, but in the winter, they're kind of spilling over, creating boggy areas. And it attracts a whole diversity of different birds, particularly shorebirds. So I'm expecting a top-class nature reserve. People will come down here and will have boards which will explain the history and the whole lot. And I hope they will look at the pictures of 20 years and go, no, surely not. Wow, isn't this absolutely fantastic? And take it as a really good example of what a community can do if they just get on with it. Yeah, sure, things are bad in the world, but if everybody does their little bit, they get better.
Will Creswell there at the Kilmining Community Nature Reserve.
They're making amazing amazing progress on this project. Will messaged me yesterday to say that he thinks they've only got about a week's worth of work. I just can't speak, so let's give up now. A week's worth of work to do.
Let's have a few moments of silence. Just listen to the birds for a while to create the wetlands.
Yeah, so a week to go and the wetland will be done, which is great. Great progress given the weather we've had.
And they're not allowed to touch the tarmac because the tarmac is listed.
Yeah. So the airfield is listed, as you might expect. World War II airfield. So it's not just the buildings, but it's the tarmac as well. So if they'd wanted to remove the tarmac, they would have had to go through a process of delisting it, which, as you know, that's not an easy process.
Might take a wee while, I suspect.
Yeah, a long time. And also, actually, removing the tarmac might have been quite expensive.
Yeah, sure.
So they just decided.
Probably not tarmac, actually. Probably concrete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a bit hard standing. I wonder, actually, I can't remember Crail Airfield. Certainly Second World War. I wonder if it predates it. Does it go back as far as the First World War?
I'm tempted to say no, but I could be wrong.
Yeah,
probably one of the listeners will know.
If you know,
I then do get in touch. But it is interesting if that surface will actually create quite an interesting effect, because he thinks it'll be very dry in the summer but actually pretty wet in the winter, and that crucial period for wildfires kind of between sort of March and June might be quite good for them. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway,
we turn our attention to another part of the country making a bid to become Scotland's third national park.
The campaign for a Scottish Borders National Park has been on the go for quite a few years. And I met up with a couple of members of that group, Alan Bailey and Malcolm Dixon. And the first question I said to them was, what area is your bid covering?
It's centred on the old county of Roxburgh, a very ancient county where the town of Roxburgh at the centre of it was, in its day, a huge trading town for the Borders and indeed for the rest of Scotland. So it's that area which, with Jedburgh in the middle, goes down to the Scottish border on the Cheviots, comes up to Kelso and across to roundabout Leaderfoot.
One of the characteristics of the national parks is it's got to be an area of outstanding natural beauty. Clearly that fits.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because it's not typically wild and romantic like some of the national parks, you know, the Lake District or Cairngorms or whatever, but it is, it's a beautiful countryside. Some people say it's our best kept secret, but we've got to use that secret, we've got to use it as an asset, because the Borders needs some coordination of its effort.
Alan, why do you want it to be a national park?
Well, to follow on from what Malcolm was saying, just across the border, they think the countryside is beautiful enough to preserve as a national park. And we're no less beautiful. It's just a different way of looking at it. We have a very special identity, which is not entirely the same as the other areas of Scotland. The Borders are very distinct culturally. The rolling hills are recognisable and loved by all. And south of the Central Belt is a different type of Scotland to north of it. And I think that it's just as valuable, and the national park that we're proposing is the gem, the sort of the gem of that whole area.
What would you be able to do as a national park that you can't do now?
We would have, if you like, a permanent publicity campaign. It's all very well, there are bodies who campaign to increase tourism in different parts of Scotland, and they do as good a job as they possibly can. But it's generally, well, it's always a fleeting moment in time. A national park would give the longer-term coordination of that, but coordination of other things, because tourism isn't the main aim here. Yes, we'd like to extend our tourism season. We'd like to attract responsible people, and we've got lots of good ideas how you do that and manage visitors. But we want to advertise the unique selling point, which is the link between our natural heritage, including our landscape, and our history and our cultural heritage, which is alive and well and kicking today. The celebrations include things like our riding festivals, our common ridings. They're not really put on for people to come and see them as spectators or increase tourism, because it's the people celebrating their pride in their own place. And these things are carved into the landscape. From the hilltops, you've got sheep farms, you've got the sheep bringing wool to the abbeys growing wealthy on that. You've got literary heritage of Sir Walter Scott and the Ettrick Shepherd. All of those intertwine to make a unique selling point, I think, for the Scottish Borders.
You run a couple of businesses in the area. What difference would it make to people generally, you know, in the Borders if it were a national park?
The national park label is internationally recognised. And for us, running tourism business, getting footfall is very important. We employ locally, and holding those jobs, keeping those people employed, as well as making a bit of money for ourselves, relies on people recognising that the Borders is a lovely place to come. And so having the national park tag would really help in the marketing. We have organisations that are running programmes, and the South of Scotland Destination Alliance is running a programme at the moment, hoping to, I think they quoted a figure of $1 billion over 10 years, extra income to the borders. And that's very well, but there are six guys in an office and they don't have powers to provide infrastructure for tourism. They don't have conservation powers. So I think having the national park would do a lot for tourism and as an overarching multifaceted body, it would be much more effective than, you know, individual bodies doing their own little jobs in their own patches.
Have you got the community behind you in this? And I ask this knowing that Borders Council are not behind this bid.
Yes, that's quite surprising, I suppose. We know that we've got the community behind us. We know that most, if not all, of the community councils in the Roxburgh, the old Roxburgh county area, are fully supportive of us. And indeed, many councillors were privately supportive in the past. Scottish Borders Council have been giving us slightly mixed messages. They responded to a report from their civil servants by saying these campaigners haven't made the area big enough, but we don't want a national park. So that's a kind of a mixed message for me.
What I've taken from their attitude is that it's not that they're against a national park or the idea of a national park, because they themselves consulted various bodies and Nature Scott, talked to Nature Scott and things, about a national park that stretched from coast to coast right across the southern part of Scotland. And
Borders and Dumfries and Galloway.
Together, yes. And so they explored that idea. They left it rather late in the day. We've been working for 7 years, and they started their consultation about 2-3 months ago. So they didn't leave themselves much time. They didn't give us support, and I'm not quite sure why that is, but we took away that they like the idea of a national park, they see advantages in it, and so we are proceeding with our application, and we don't regard their lack of support as any particular hurdle. In fact, it used to be that local authority support was a requisite of proposing a new national park. But when this current process was announced by the Scottish Government, that requisite was dropped. So they were looking for suggestions from communities.
That was Alan Bailey and Malcolm Dixon for the Borders bid for Scotland's next national park there.
Yeah, there are a couple of other areas making bids. We still have to get to them. Skye and Loch Awe. We hope to hear from them very soon.
The Borders bid, I was thinking about it, is how you actually delineate the community. When I say, I mean, just about every community enterprise, everything that involves a community, first you have to define what the community is. That's really very, very important as a step. Mm-hmm. You know, how you actually go about doing it, where you set those limits.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, could you have one park that covers the whole of the south of Scotland?
It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, it is.
But I think one of the key points in the bid paper is that it has to be geographically distinct.
Yeah.
So it's how, again, it's setting off that separation.
Yeah. It's interesting that both the bids in the south of Scotland have had a sort of campaign behind them for a number of years. Yeah. You know, this is not something that's just suddenly
didn't surprise
popped
them.
Up. No, yeah. Definitely not. They've had a long time to work on this.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, as you say, there's a couple more areas making bids, Skye and Loch Awe. I think you're going to Skye, are you?
I think so. I think that's the plan.
I must be going to Loch Awe then. By a process of elimination, that'll be it. Now, recently, Helen was visiting Leavenmouth Academy in Buckhaven and Fife to learn about a rewilding project underway there. The bit of land in question, like a lot of Fife, is on a former mine. And as a result, previous efforts to plant trees there have been pretty well pointless, to be honest.
Yeah, the teacher involved, Duncan Zuell, is determined to make it work, though, and has been experimenting with various techniques to reinvigorate the soil and keep the deer away so that a mini forest will thrive.
One of those ideas involves something called a fedge. But as Duncan points out, one of the main paradoxes within the project is the fact that to try and get the trees to grow in the first place, they are reliant on plastic tree guards.
So you've obviously put a lot of thought into this place. How did you go about designing it?
I had an idea and we kept adding to it.
Uh-huh. So it evolved?
It has evolved. I've collected what I think works, done something, then stopped doing it if it didn't work. It's really an assemblage of ideas that we've been working on. And we've just been experimenting to see what we can do. So, for example, when it came to deer, how do we deal with deer?
So is it a lot of roe deer you get coming
here? We get,
here?
Yeah, roe deer. And
eating your trees?
Eating the trees, that's right. The tree guards have a kind of double-edged effect. They stunt the tree. They're plastic. They're held up with stakes that are, again, cut down trees, which is ironic. We've tried to think of a way that we could plant trees without using plastic tree guards or stakes. And we've got this project here where we've got a ditch in a circle, which we're going to fill with manure and then plant a hedge of willow branches that will make a natural barrier to stop the deer coming in. Because it's in a circle, the deer will only be able to rub up against one side of the willow branches, and so that won't kill the willow. And they won't be able to get past the willow to eat the young trees that are in here. We've added more nutrients into the soil to give the soil a lot of things that the roots will like. A lot of moisture will be held in the soil.
So lots of chippings, yeah, and mulch and so
on. Yeah, we've got a turbocharged little tree planting zone here. And hopefully it'll be a plastic-free, tree stake-free place where the trees grow much, much faster. And we'll find really satisfying tree plantation here.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And actually, have you been sharing your thinking with the young people then as this has evolved?
Yeah, basically this is the third project that we've got, and this time we're calling it Becoming Wolves in Batswood Wolves, because we're replicating the effect of wolves by keeping the deer out of some areas by using this willow fence. We can actually help the trees to grow without any deer eating them. That's teaching them a little bit about how wolves affect biodiversity and how they affect landscapes. And at the same time, we're working on a project that will change our landscape.
And how do they respond to that idea of talking about wolves and so on?
It takes them a while to get it sometimes. It's a little bit imaginative. It's a little bit out there. It's a little bit poetic, if you like. But then I kind of tell them about the science and about the how it works, and they can kind of see what I mean. And they're like, well, I don't know, Mr. Zill, you might be a bit strange.
But the proof will be in the pudding, won't it?
Exactly. It might work, you know. So, we're actually supported by a grant to create this tree planting effort, and we'll make a video, and hopefully we'll share the success of our planting project as an idea, as a technology, if you like, for planting trees in a different way, in a plastic-free, more environmentally friendly way. Some good might come out of that.
How much is the plastic-free aspect of importance to the young people as well? Are they into that, thinking of other ways?
A lot of kids do care about plastic very much. And if you look on Google Maps, you can actually see the plastic in this area from space. The light green colour of these plastic tree guards are actually visible on Google Maps satellite pictures. So that's a lot of plastic we're talking about. And it's so ironic that we've got environmental measure that is actually plastic that's visible from space, you know, with trees that didn't grow. It's quite demoralising when you think about it. So we've got to do something to improve the soil, to put the trees back, to try and accomplish what was a good idea.
But that, I mean, that must warm your heart here.
Oh, absolutely it does. Just things like this little forest space that we're looking at. Our colleagues in Nature Scott are working on a thing called Wee Forests, or Tiny Forests, as part of a kind of project. And what's this, a 10-metre diameter circle? And the number of trees and the amount of biodiversity that we're going to see in here in a few years' time is incredible. We're looking at Duncan and the pupils' handiwork in front of us, still muddy and fresh. But actually, it's part of a much bigger thought about, well, what if we could put this in so many schools? What if we could learn from this? And again, you've just heard from Duncan about learning those kind of permaculture, working with nature type attitudes. that teaches some values and skills for the future. And that makes me really happy, really happy.
You know, the thing that I love is the fact that it's part of a school and there is learning. It's happening. The learning is happening right here with what Duncan's doing. It's just, it couldn't be better, really, could it?
No, it couldn't. And again, it's that twin track of not only are pupils learning, but we are changing the local environment quite dramatically. And by the time those pupils are Duncan and my age, actually, this place will look and feel totally different. We'll be walking through a small forest, which is just amazing.
You've got this wonderful space to experiment, and you're learning all the time through what's happening here and trial and error.
Well, that's right. It's been very, very lucky to have this opportunity to experiment and to campaign, if you like. It's just fallen into place for me.
Duncan Zuhl, they're a teacher at Leavenworth Academy, and we also heard from Matt Robinson from Learning from Landscapes.
Yeah, we were looking up the definition of fedge, weren't we?
It's a living hedge.
Living hedge.
It's a cross between fence and hedge. It'd be really interesting to see if that works. Mm-hmm. I suspect the deer might find the willow delicious.
Appetising.
That very, very, very appetising, don't know. Because that got us thinking about these plastic tree guards, because both of us spent a long time on the western peripheral route going about Aberdeen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it runs basically from one coast all the way around to Stonehaven. And there will be hundreds of thousands of trees planted there, all of them in these little plastic tree guards, etc. And, you know, are they biodegradable? Are they necessarily a bad thing? Are there alternatives? Well, joining us now to explain is George Anderson from Woodland Trust Scotland. Morning, George.
Good morning.
You are actually going to be out and about tree planting today. Where are you?
Well, I'm speaking to you just now from our digs, which are just near the bottom of the Bialachnabar.
All right.
Applecross. And we're kicking off a major woodland creation scheme today with a community planting effort in Ben Shieldaig. We've got about 500,000 trees to go in the next 5 years. Don't know how many we'll get through this morning, but we'll do our best to get in about it. But we won't be using plastic tree tubes, and the Woodland Trust no longer uses single-use plastic tubes. So where we have to use the tubes, we go in and get them out after they've done their job. I think it's fair to say, actually, that the old tubes, they're getting a bad name now, but they've actually done an amazing job for our country since 1979. A guy called Graham Chooley invented them, and he went on to become the conservator of Kincardine and Deeside for the Forest Commission in the 80s. And there are actually lots of lovely woods all over the country now that are there because of Graham's invention, which he didn't patent and didn't make a fortune from. But the person who patents the biodegradable version, they're going to make a fortune. And there's lots of people trying to do that just now.
Yeah, I bet they are. So just to rewind a little bit, what are you using then if you're not using these tubes? Nothing at all?
We are testing lots of alternatives at the moment with various companies. So the two sides to it is that you've got your tubes, which everyone sees, which are for deer protection mostly. But we also use Volgaards, because little rodents love the bottom base bit of trees once they get away. So you'll see these little spiral things sometimes at the bottom of a tree to keep the voles and mice off. So we are still using some plastic ones of those, but the place we're planting today, we'll be planting some alternatives and we'll see how they're doing. And down south, our colleagues, there's a wood that we have in England where we've actually, it's a testing zone for these, and we've got dozens of different versions on the go, which we're basically waiting to see how they get on, and we add two or three every year to that. The challenge is we need it to stay working for 5 years and not fall apart, and that's quite difficult to achieve, to get it. And actually at the moment, I think the best thing is that we go in and we take them out. That, you know, that's part of the job. You don't just leave them.
What does the tube actually do? I mean, you take a plastic tube, you put it around basically a small, small tree, you know, and the tree's not poking out the top yet, etc. What is the purpose of that tube?
So two things. It keeps the grazing animals off it. And the second thing is it gives it a little greenhouse in there that's lovely conditions to grow quickly. So that means it grows up quicker than it would otherwise. And in doing that, it gets beyond the zone where the deer will browse on it. All of this is, we think we're a normal country. We're just totally not a normal country. Most of the rest of the world doesn't plant trees. Trees just grow because they've got their grazing pressure under control. We have, from the minute a seedling pokes its head out from above the soil a siege, you know. So we've got fences and we've got tubes and we've got all this, that and the other. It all comes down to the fact that we've got too much grazing pressure. And, you know, we're really hoping that we'll get to a stage where not only do we not need to protect trees that we plant, we don't actually need to plant trees at all because they'll just do their own thing. You know, trees were growing a long time before we started planting them.
When you're thinking about these tubes, I'm now beginning to wonder if I've imagined this, but I think I read that there was a company, maybe in the south of Scotland, using wool as an alternative to the plastic tubes. Would that be right?
That's one of the things we've been trialled. And actually, there's a product that's widely used in Europe, which is made from sheep fat. And it would appear that deer, they don't like the taste of anything to do with the sheep.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a Larson cartoon.
There's certainly irony in that, George, isn't
there? Yeah, there's a Larson cartoon to be had in here. But actually, if you paint, mutton fat onto a seedling, it apparently makes it less palatable. Making it less palatable to me as well, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, you know, there's lots of ideas like that, but I don't think anyone's in a position yet where we're going, yeah, this is the one, this is the solution.
What height has a sapling got to get to before it stops being a target for deer?
Well, do you know, they're actually remarkably lazy. Where they get browsed is literally where the deer's head is at. They're pretty much not even prepared to lift their head up. And we, you know, at our woodhead in Benfield, I've seen Scots pine, and you can see the absolute hammering they take about a metre and a bit off the ground, and then they're fine and they're beyond that. And the deer could reach that, they don't need to because they just go on the next tree and it's at the right level for them.
Do you find that although the intention is there, sometimes these plastic tubes are just left lying around even after they're needed?
Yes, I think that has been an issue, and certainly in the Woodland Trust, we make that a big kind of volunteering activity. You know, we've got corporate sponsors who like nothing better than the staff coming out in a wee day and getting in about a wood and moving tubes. It doesn't sound like fun, but actually, for some people, in a one day to do that, it's good fun. So that's one of our tasks, you know, and I think that has to be built in. People have to think about it. You can't just put it in and expect to leave it. You need to remove it. And they can't, you know, they are also reusable two or three times in most cases. So they should be being reused rather than just abandoned.
Well, thank you very much for that information, George, and good luck with the planting today. How's the weather?
Well, it's looking good just now. We think we might get a bit of snow, which is fine. I believe you've got a bit of rain over where you are.
Yes, a little.
Keep that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, no, thank you very much for joining us. And remember, if it's not snowing, are you even tree planting? That was George Anderson there from the Woodland Trust Scotland. You're listening to Outdoors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stevens, sitting right next to me. Well, trying to get as close to the fire as she can here in Beechgrove is Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this, umpteen ways of listening again.
Yeah, we tell you this all the time. You can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds. And lots of people definitely do that.
Yes. We get that anecdotally all the time. There is the Scotland Outdoors podcast available from BBC Sounds. We ask every week, where do you listen to this podcast? Let us know. Neil Caldwell from Largs did say, dear all out at Out of Doors, a wee note to say thank you. I've listened to you for years on the radio, listening via BBC Sounds, which lets me listen either while at work or listen again or live while the family is asleep. Recently, Mrs. Caldwell, significant other, I suspect, has been getting a new man by instalments. Excellent. After getting a new hip in September, my work has kindly moved me to the office temporarily while I recover.
I'm now getting back on the tractor and out in the yard slowly and still think some of your mystery sounds seem like the noises I make while doing physio exercises. So just to say thank you, says Neil Caldwell. Now it's time for our mystery sound again. Let's have a listen.
This is causing a certain amount of chaos because we haven't got anything approaching a close answer. So, I'm going to give you two clues here.
Go on then.
One, it's not mechanical. Two, because that's standard, that's contractual. We have to say that nowadays. And two, it's a form of roof.
Okay.
Okay.
See how you get on with that. Janet from Perth says, is today's mystery noise a bird, a pigeon maybe, as there are lots of them, as Mark suggested, trapped in a garage or fruit cage and flapping to find its way out? By the way, Perth is the same with roadworks. We are festooned with diversion signs.
Karen in a white Shetland says, is the mystery sound a trailer load of neeps tipped into a neep chapper to feed the kai in the byre? They had an early one at the Agriculture Museum near Mintlaw with the explanation that cows fared better when given chopped up neeps rather than just the whole ones. They're too lazy to eat the whole ones, to be honest, Karen. Mm.
Marion Caithness, I think the mystery sound is a batch of doos being let out of a transit crate to start their journey home. I have no connection to the doo world whatsoever, so why I think this, I have no idea.
Why not? Says, and Dougie and Anya and Cooper say, we believe the mystery sound is a thingy. You know, there's lots of them rattling their way to Murrayfield and the rugby today, like us.
Alan Mark says, good morning, Mark and Rachel. Very wet here in West Lothian. Is the mystery sound apples in a cider press? Leo the Labrador has been out and got very wet indeed.
Rob Crawford, for the honest tune, says, my body is a mechanism that I can seldom switch off. I don't know if I should read the rest of this. It wakens me on most Saturdays at 06:30 to Radio Scotland and keeps me amused, intrigued and interested for an hour and a half. Any advice on how I can fix this? Listen, Rob, you get no sympathy from us. We have the same thing, but it works at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Michael Droy and Ewan on our way to work in Paisley. The mystery sound is a fish in the bottom of a boat, perhaps.
And Claudia Vivian and Pepper the Puppy thinks it might be a wheelbarrow going over gravel or a kookaburra with a cough.
Ah, clever suggestion. Trying to tie it into things that we've been talking about this week. Still lots of time for a guess. Out of doors at bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or give us a ring 0808 59295 00.
Let's go back, and we just mentioned kookaburras, to the bird gardens at Lauder and the Borders. Now, it is a haven for all kinds of wildlife from home and abroad. I asked Director Owen Joyner how his interest in birds in particular had started.
My mother was a very astute woman. I grew up in Caithness, and for my 6th birthday, I got 6 chickens. It certainly allowed me to explore my main interest, which is working with birds. That interest took me into the field. I spent a few years up in the Himalayas chasing endangered pheasants around the mountains, and that was fantastic. But what I realised I missed the most is hands-on, the actual conservation breeding side.
So how do you learn the skills necessary to run a place like this?
Wow, so I've had various jobs and life experiences that have given me the bird, hands-on bird experience. And in terms of establishing a zoo and all that paperwork, the bald spots on my head testify to how stressful that can be. But I've been in the zoo world for a while and I've got some good contacts. And we just managed to get through all the paperwork and get our zoo licence in place.
And you can hear the parrots just whistling and squeaking in the background.
So these are all victims of COVID. There's lots of things going on with COVID that are sort of longer term impacts than just the human issue that we had. So these parrots belonged to somebody who didn't get better. And as with a dog or a cat, the family take the pet in. But unfortunately with the parrots, and the grey parrots in particular, are brilliant at mimicking. So, of course, they're sat in the family's house mimicking deceased relatives, which is awful. So we had...
I'd never thought of that.
Yeah, it's...
You always think of it in, the, sort of, in terms of the sort of the humorous side of things, but that must be really quite distressing.
It must have been awful. So we had 8 parrots come in during COVID, and we applied to a COVID emergency fund and told them this story, basically, and they gave us some money and said build them somewhere lovely to live. So we did plan to work with the grey parrots anyway because they're horribly endangered in the wild. But as it happens, we've got this horrible COVID-related story and we've turned it into a little conservation breeding programme. What we're finding now is that they've stopped plucking and they've naturalised their behaviours because they're in a more natural environment. Yeah, it's a real positive of something that was really quite horrific.
Where do you get your stock from? I mean, aside from that, the story you've just told me.
So the domestics you can buy and sell in the public sector, they're easy to get hold of, and thankfully there's a large network of people who work with these rare breeds. In terms of the Chilean flamingos here, they came in from a couple of different institutions as eggs, and we applied to the stud books for various things, like the white-winged wood duck is a critically endangered bird who probably will be extinct in our lifetimes. So we apply to the stud book to work with them, and then after deliberation with the stud book, they'll allocate us some birds that are genetically suitable, and then it's my job to get them together, pair them up and make babies. So there's lots of different ways that birds can come to us. We have parrots that have come in that have been confiscated at various airports. We don't know their full stories, but they get vet checked, and if they're in good health, then we offer to take them on and give them a decent life. So there's lots of different ways that birds can come to us. Our preferred method is to go through official stud books and be part of official, globally coordinated conservation breeding programmes.
You will remember lucky bags, the stuff that comes out of border controls. It must be the same kind of thing. You don't know what you're going to get, and it's very exciting at the time. But there's also a worry. Presumably, you put them into some sort of isolation before they get introduced into the wider population.
Yeah, so for instance, we had 40-odd parrots of various...
40?
Yeah, 40 came in one van load. So there's cockatoos and there's rosellas and there's... rainbow lorikeets, a lot of which are actually endangered in the wild. These ones, I suspect, I don't know. Again, it's a legal matter, we're not privy to information, but I suspect they were pets because they're quite tame. But yes, you open a box and you're like, oh, it's a rainbow lorikeet, so we need to jump online and buy some nectar so that we can feed and care for it properly. So it's quite exciting, but it's just a reminder that, crossing ports and things with animals now, it's something people have to consider because you will lose your pet.
Yeah, you will lose your pet. And the other thing that was making me smile when you were talking about that was the thought of, the white van drivers that come up our drive, how would they react to being told to transport 40 parrots to somewhere? I mean, is that a specialist job?
Oh, very much so. There's specialist animal transporters who basically work for zoos and move everything from lions to parrots around the country and sometimes into Europe if all the paperwork and things are in place. So these guys get contacted by the airports and they're basically commissioned to find appropriate, good, permanent homes for these confiscated animals. And in terms of parrots, we seem to be quite high up the list.
This all started off, you said, basically with your mum buying you 6 chickens, however many years ago. What is this like as a lifestyle? I mean, if you could choose exactly what your life was going to be, how close would it be to this?
This would be it. I talked about opening a zoo when I was a kid. It took the form then of a petting farm. I grew up on a croft in the north of Scotland, so that was a logical thought for me. But by the time I left home at 17, I was working with quite a lot of endangered pheasants and ducks in the back garden. And yeah, here we are, building a zoo. So 6 years ago, there were nothing here but sheep. And now we've planted 6,000 trees, there's flamingos, ponds, and we've just had a grant come through to take the paths up over the hill into the second part of the grounds where we're just starting to build grouse aviaries. Capercaillie, we want to work with the Scottish wildcats as well. All the native species are in trouble. Conservation isn't just about things in the Caribbean chasing turtles around beautiful islands. There's also a lot of issues here. Scottish wildcat, red squirrel, there's lots of things that we can get involved with here that we can be directly involved with, potentially release programmes into areas that are suitable. Yeah, there's lots going on. It's a very exciting time.
Oh, enjoying our bird garden, Scotland there. And it is here for such a small space, they packed a lot in.
Yeah, a lot in there, yeah. And it's a really interesting idea that sometimes parrots are handed in because, of course, they've got this ability to mimic, their owners. And, of course, that could be distressing. I've never really thought that before.
No, I haven't thought of it either, I must confess. But, and also the fact that, because they are now almost a sort of a receiving station for stuff that is picked up at the borders, they have literally no idea what's coming off the boat,
Yeah, I wonder if they have to take specialist advice sometimes on how they deal with some of these creatures.
I would imagine so. Sorry, I know this is noisy, and I apologise, but we do make the bacon every week, and it's beginning to burn, so I need to flip it. There we go. Sorted. Then I want burnt bacon.
We've also moved quite close to the fire because it is cold.
Well, you're more or less on top of it.
Yeah, pretty much so. The spark's the only thing keeping me going.
Yeah.
Alistair and Elkin's been in touch. Please advise Mark that he was correct with this rendition of the Max Bygrave hit. If you've just joined us, you're thinking, what on earth are you talking about?
Then on the stage. Right then. There we go, right. Is there anything else?
Getting back to the mystery sound there. John in the Black Isle says, enjoying my usual Saturday morning listen, a great programme. Is the mystery sound a muck spreader?
This is slightly obtuse. Is it someone pulling a canoe trail over frozen, rutted ground, says Ross and Tainall?
Yeah.
That's remarkably close, but no. And I said it involves living things, this.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He says, I'm off up a very windy and snowy Cairngorm today training with Oban Mountain Rescue Team. Excellent.
Okay. Scott Nadia from Bothwell says, in keeping with the Chinese New Year theme, is the sound of rickety rickshaw going over a rugged track?
Tongue twister.
Absolutely. I got it right, though. I don't care.
Right. Yep. Well done. Now, if you've been to Aberdeen Beach recently, you may have spotted two gigantic dogs sporting pairs of goggles. Yes, goggles, carrying out practice rescue operations in the sea. Have you seen them, Mark?
I haven't.
No.
I think I would have remembered.
You think so? Yeah. They're called Yogi and Cindy. Nice names. And while their efforts attract a fair bit of attention here, it's more commonplace for dogs to be used in water rescues abroad. Well, I met up with them and their owner, Norman McConaughey. I wasn't really prepared for just how big they are.
Cindy, come.
Thank you. Oh. I know.
Is there a bit of rivalry for your attention?
Cindy's totally domineering over Yogi. She's a little diva. I had a good girl.
Kisses.
Good girl. It's like everything. You don't really put into perspective how big they really are on a picture on social media until you actually come and meet them themselves. So just to give you an idea, Yogi's actually just over 85 kilograms and Cindy's just... she's almost about 63 kilograms. So it's pretty heavy.
Now, they're Newfoundlands and they are fantastic in the water, aren't they?
So Newfoundlands are basically Canadian water rescue dogs. They were bred for originally with fishermen taking in fishing lines, or the fishermen used to take the dogs out in the boats with them to assist them if they need help in the water.
And you've trained your dogs to help in rescue operations as well, haven't you?
So I'm the only person at the moment at it has proper registered water rescue dogs in the UK. There is other groups that do like water experiences, etc., like the Scottish Newfoundland Club. But I'm also a surf lifeguard with Aberdeen Surf Life Saves, the same group. So it's an asset. So it's another asset to saving people and prevention of water safety.
So it probably sounds like a daft question, but what is it they will do if you see someone in trouble in the water?
So obviously their unique characteristics, they've got that natural instinct to find the safest route back to land from sea or water. Unlike us humans, we have to actually think about it. Their natural instinct, they've got more pulling power and endurance in the water than what I would have as if I'm rescuing you with a rescue board.
So they've got the ability to go in and pull you out.
So they could be launched off a beach or a lock or any water situation and fast launch on their own. So if you are, for speaking sake, a conscious casualty, it's quite easy to launch them on their own because, one, they can go out to you and you could grab onto the back of them and they'll tow you back to shore. But it's a little bit more complicated if you're unconscious because, one, 9 times out of 10, I would have to go out as the first responder to assess the situation and maybe if I had to give you rescue breaths and CPR. But the good thing there is the dog can actually pull us back, pull us back on land whilst we're doing that. I'm doing the first responder part on you.
Yogi's just given you a wee pool there himself.
I know. He's starting to get in this water, but he's not happening.
No, fair enough. I think he would take a wee minute to dry, wouldn't he?
When I do take him down to the beach for a bit of enjoyment, I've got equipment back at home that I can actually go and dry them off. But normally it would take you to groom someone like Yogi at his sort of size. A full groom would be easy, 3 hours. But a quick dry, you're probably at least an hour to try and blow most of the water out.
To get back to the rescues again,
yeah,
they can even be involved in helicopter rescue, can't they?
So, sadly, in the UK, we don't have that sort of funding like we do have in Europe and America. Like the Italians is probably the leaders in the world that actually do water rescue, and they've got a water rescue school with canines. They are trained to be able to jump and launch from helicopters, rib boats and various other parts of equipment, where the Coast Guard in Italy and emergency services use them every single day. Where over in the UK, one, it's quite hard to get a hold of a Newfoundland, and two, it will take you about 2.5 years to fully train one because they're not fully developed until 2.5 years old when they're actually pulling equipment or boats or etc. back on land.
So they're used quite a bit abroad, but it's just not something that's really done here yet.
They are aware of what their capabilities are, but the problem we have in the UK is red tape. How do we get on with it? How do we get combined services to actually to do training with us? The lifespan of the dog as well, and injuries, is which we've got to take into consideration. First and foremost, these guys are always going to be more an assistance base, which I'm an assistant dog trainer. The major asset these guys have is prevention. When I do something like a beach patrol, Yogi can detect up to 30 minutes of a cardiac and epileptic seizure. He's seizure alert trained, assistance based, and he's trained on depressurization. And Cindy's also trained by working with autistic and PBD. So when we're dealing with physical and people with mental disabilities and maybe had to rescue or save them. For speaking sake, if you have a child that's autistic and you're maybe struggling in the water, the dog can be quite, can become quite therapeutic and grounding to them, so it can control that situation, so it becomes a more calming environment.
People must be astonished when they see these animals in the water rescuing people.
It's not unusual in Europe and America because they use service dogs every day. Where in the UK, when you actually see Yogi and Cindy actually training or doing stuff in the water with equipment and stuff, their first thing they ask is, why is the glasses on? Why have they got glasses?
Explain that then.
So the protection glasses is obviously because you can see the glare today, but it's also if they are in the water and they do need to be winched up by a helicopter, is to stop any debris blowing into their eyes and protect their face. And it also gives them more focus on what they're actually doing, and they understand with the glasses on, they're working.
Do you think we'll get to a stage where dogs are used more routinely in these kind of rescue operations?
It's where the funding would come along. It's like having guide dogs. It's like having all these assistant dogs. It's all right becoming a trainer, but it's being able to actually get the dogs that can do that job. Like a Newfoundland is a great asset, but trying to get one, then train one, is the problem. That's why we have to have enough dogs to create a school, so we've got that asset of having 10 different Newfoundland dogs we could use. Because you can appreciate, in a day like here, if I had to go and do quite a big rescue in the water, I could only use the dog once a day, because one, it would need to recover, or it might pick up an injury. And if it picks up an injury, that, he's no use.
They are stunning dogs. They've got near black coats, big and fluffy, big brown eyes. I mean, they're super, super cute. What are they like to train?
They can be very stubborn. Newfoundlands are stubborn. So as you've probably seen, if Yogi doesn't want to do something, he gives it a wee seat and he uses his body weight. He knows he's big. But again, the key to these guys is, one, is to make them want to be with you.
Yogi, come. Cindy, come. Let's go.
Nora McConaughey there, along with Cindy and Yogi there.
Yeah, they've got a big following on social media.
I bet they do.
Yeah, Military Fitness Aberdeen, I think, if you want to see very cute pictures of them.
And they drop them out of helicopters in other countries?
In other countries, yeah, not here though.
You think it'd be bad enough nearly drowning without somebody dropping a 14-stone dog in?
I don't know if that's quite the aim.
Well, possibly not, but it's always a possibility.
Someone's been in touch about the Creel tarmac question. Mm-hmm. Alan Giles says, in reference to your question as to when the tarmac at Creel Airfield was laid, the tarmac at Kilmining is likely to be associated with the Second World War activity at the airfield. Creel Museum have plenty of maps and photographs which would help check this out. The museum reopens for 2024 at Easter.
Well, we have a mystery sound this week, and thank you for those comments about Creel Airfield. We have a mystery sound this week. Let's have a quick listen to it again. Incorrect answers from Fred Gordon and Armadale said, is it the noise of wind in a poly tunnel? Or Linda and David and Kirk and Tillich thought it may be a horse-drawn cart over a gravel path. They're heading for a swim at Loch Lubnig.
Oh! John Prentice, who's in the French Pyrenees, says, is the mystery sound a driver sitting in his car listening to hailstones pummeling the bodywork whilst trying to calculate what the effect on this might be on his no-claims bonus?
True. Gavin from Cooper says, I think the sound is rain on a felt shed roof, and David and Levin thought it might be sheep getting ready to be dipped.
Mm. Now, yeah, good guesses.
There's a bit here that says, read out correct answers. Here we go.
Have I got to do it?
No, there isn't one. There isn't one. The absolute closest we've got is Leslie Boddy from Methlick, who thought it might be hailstones falling on a perspex roof. And I say it's the closest because...
Oh, yes, I thought this is what you meant. Nick Brett sent this in. He's one of our listeners. He says, I have a contribution for the mystery sound item. This was recorded under clear laminated sheet roofing with birds feeding on corn placed on the roof in Shetland.
Obviously.
Yeah, the birds feeding are the rather frenzied resident subspecies of starling. This is your bit, Mark.
Mm-hmm. Sturnus vulgaris atlanticus, local to Shetland and the Western Isles.
Well done. So that would make full identification a wee bit more challenging if you want to be pedantic, says Nick.
I have actually heard that sound, Nick. Without a word of a lie, I had a flock of starlings on my flat roof bathing in a puddle there, and it sounded remarkably similar. Anyway, that's it. Don't forget the New Scotland Outdoors podcast, available today at noon. We've got another one midweek from all of the team here in BBC Aberdeen. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.